Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Lost in Science. It's half an hour on your radio where we're talking about science things. Who are we? Well, once again, we've got four people in a studio. I'm Stu, and with me I've got Lyndon and Kat and Chris.
Hey there.
Hello.
How are you?
Very well, very well. Now, Chris, I know you've got a story for us this week. What are you going to be gracing us with? Its presence.
Well, I hate to say it, I've got another quantum story.
It is Hooray!
The quantum, it is the year for it.
It is the quantum year, yeah. And look, this is a story that's a few weeks old now. This big announcement by Microsoft. Did you catch that one?
No. Oh, the quantum computing one from Microsoft.
Yeah,
they've broken
yeah.
some limit, I think, something like that.
I'm glad that it's poorly remembered from all of you, because at the time it was like this big announcement. I thought, oh, should I cover this straight away? Should I drop everything and cover this? And I was like, no, I'll sit on it for a bit. And I'm glad I did, because it hasn't quite turned out to be what all the hype was about. But I'm kind of also glad it's kind of encouraging that, you know, you switch on science, people don't really remember it anyway. It's kind of glossed over you. So there were some messages in here about science communication, I'm sure, somewhere. But yeah, look, we'll dig into that in fact, what they actually claim to have done, what they actually did, and what any of this actually means, and whether the whole kind of quantum computing industry, how much of it is hype and how much of it is
so much of it is hype, I mean, surely. But I mean, you know, I'm just on the topic of science news at the moment, a lot of the science news coming out of America is really bad. Programs getting cut, research yes. getting canned, all sorts of things like that. It's you know, it's hard to remember anything positive among all of that, I think, at
this,
the moment.
This so. Is true.
And Lyndon, you're going to be talking to someone. You've got an interview this week.
Yes, yes, I do. Stu, I will be talking to Saini Samim, not doctor quite yet. She submitted her PhD thesis just a couple of weeks ago. She is, I think she's a geochemist. Maybe that's what she would call herself. We can let her clarify that. But her work has been looking at chemistry of rocks and using those to really accurately date the timing of volcanic eruptions. She's been using high-tech, fancy equipment. She's been looking at pumice stones as well. So these are the bits of lava that have been ejected from a volcano and then they've cooled kind of in the air, you know, the pumice that you use to clean up your dirty feet. So she's been using the chemistry within those pumice stones to help us really accurately date the timing of volcanic eruptions millions and millions of years in the past. So, yeah, it's a really I'm really looking forward to chatting to her.
Cool. Yeah, interesting story. Well, two completely unrelated stories this week on Lost in Science. Please stay tuned.
Yes, you're listening to Lost in Science, and I'm talking about some quantum computing shenanigans. Now, this was all sparked off by a recent announcement by Microsoft, as I said in the introduction. So they had put out a media release. I'll just read the title of the media release, because that's probably a good place to start. And it kind of summarized some of the headlines around this. So Microsoft unveils Majorana 1, the world's first quantum processor powered by topological qubits. Wow.
Topological qubits.
Topological qubits. So we should probably unpack some of that.
Yeah, exactly what's definitely.
Let's do a bit of quantum computing basics here. First of all, you know what a computer is?
Yes.
Tick. Yes.
Yes. Okay. And you know that they use binary, like notation. They're bits. Like the 0, 1 is a bit.
Yes.
Okay. So it's a state within an electronic circuit is represented by a bit, which then you put a lot together, you make a computer. All right. So a qubit is the quantum version of a bit. Okay. And that's basically all it is, except that being quantum, it can be in like a combination of 0 and 1. All right.
So like in between or a combo?
probably more a combo. People often talk about like in between, but it really is more a combo. It's like Schrodinger's cat that is both dead and alive at the same time. That kind of thing. If you remember Schrodinger's cat at all, even though I don't like to talk about Schrodinger, trying to cancel him. But let's not go there. We don't want to. There's more muddier waters I've got to wade in, which will come up shortly. So that's basically what it is. It can be in a superposition, essentially, of these zero and one states. It allows you to do calculations, theoretically, that you would not be able to do with a normal computer, because you can kind of have, you know, a few couple of different options that you're weighing up at the same time and push them through. And so, in theory, you can do calculations like code cracking and this kind of stuff, complicated mathematical things, a lot quicker than you could with a computer that's limited to only zero and one at the same time. So that's what that is. Now, the topological part is a bit more complicated. So basically, it's to do with the name of the computer, which was Majorana 1. It is based on these things called Majorana particles. Now, these are named after, they're theorized by Italian physicist Ettore Majorana back in, I think, the 1930s or so. Again, dodgy figures in the history of science. Majorana was a fascist, was also a bit keen on Hitler as well. So we're not going to talk about him a lot. He did disappear in mysterious circumstances in 1938.
Swings and roundabouts then.
Yeah, swings and roundabouts.
And yet still got the name. Still got the...
Well, he came up with them and he did the theory. And I don't know, back in the day, some people liked fascists, I guess. I mean, that wouldn't happen today. I did find a note. Actually,
when was this named? Was it named around that time?
It was named after him, yeah, because he came up with the theory. One of the things, like comments I found on the Wikipedia page talking about this, apparently he praised Hitler for the fact that he was sacking public servants and replacing them with loyalists, which is something that sounds like, familiar, I guess.
Like you said, that wouldn't happen these days.
No, exactly.
Anywhere.
Anyway, so back to the physics. So Majorana particles, they are their own antiparticle. So they're like an electron or that sort of thing, but they are from their own antiparticle. So they were toyed with as a way to explain the fact that neutrinos have very low masses. I won't get into too much detail about neutrinos. They're a subatomic particle, very low mass, as the name would suggest. Neutral electric charge, but they interact with a weak nuclear force. Anyway, turned out didn't work out the same way. We generally believe that these Majorana particles don't exist as fundamental particles in the universe. However, what you find is a lot of the mass behind these things, these sort of like exotic kind of particles and states, can exist as what they call quasi-particles that come out of solid state physics, in condensed matter physics also, basically in solids, in weird combinations of atoms in the material. In this case, it's a combination of superconductors and semiconductors. You can get kind of quantum states that are basically these Majorana particles. So they're not a real particle. They're like a combination of particles together acting like one of these things.
Okay. Righto.
It's complicated. Don't worry. It's
so
complicated.
But the description of the particles isn't an actual particle, but there are situations where it behaves as if they are.
They act like they're real particles, right, even though they're kind of quasi-particles. They're like a quantum state within this material.
They act like they're real particles, or they act like it's been hypothesized that these Majorana particles would act.
Yes, essentially. So what in this particular case, they're in these superconducting nanowires made out of indium arsenide. That's not important, I guess. And so the point is that because they're not real particles, they're kind of states within this superconducting system, they're going to be more stable than a normal kind of quantum state would use for a qubit. Because this is the big problem with quantum computers, is that quantum states like these ones, they're very fragile, particularly when they come into contact with the classical world, the big world. And they need to do that if you're going to make a measurement on them to find out the result of the calculation. So there's huge errors you get in these things. Typically, it takes you like hundreds of kind of physical qubits to get an actual logical qubit that you can use to do a calculation. So you have to have your computer much bigger than it sounds like it would need to be to make an actual calculation. All right, but the idea with these topological ones is they're more robust. And so in theory, you could have essentially error-proof, you could have basically one qubit is a useful qubit that you could use to make a calculation.
Wow, Microsoft must have really worked hard on a press release to explain all of that to your average Microsoft user.
Well, they got headlines from it and they got attention in the press, but clearly, like I said, the normal people, including the science-literate people, haven't really remembered this, which is important because they may not actually have done this, is the thing. So the press release seems to imply that they have, but the language is kind of a bit weaselly. And so people kind of interpreted that, done that. They did put out a paper in Nature on basically the same date. And it has an important sentence which says the way they were measuring to detect whether they had these states. It said, these measurements do not by themselves determine whether the low energy states detected are topological. So basically, we can't prove that they're topological. They're just basically implying they built this thing. Apparently there was some secret data they released to some other people, but it hasn't really been published yet. The published paper does not prove what the media release is kind of implying.
I wonder if it's like, it's just so complicated that like the way it has been, I guess, translated, for want of a better word, is that, you know, it's just completely simplified it to the point that it's like, we did this.
It could be, or it could be that they are exaggerating a little bit. Okay. I don't want to be accusing Microsoft of anything in particular, but there were suspicions sown by the fact that they had another major paper on this work, then published in 2018, also in Nature, that then 3 years later had to be retracted because it turned out it wasn't actually what they said it was. So they've got a bad track record with this work. They kind of put out a press release saying, this is what we've done, but the paper doesn't say that's what they've done. And so people are going, we're going to wait till we see the results on this. So you actually have to do something useful for it with it to make it actually people believe you. And that's a really tough thing to do. So there was an interesting, amusing event a couple of years ago. IBM, they had a 127-qubit quantum computer called Sycamore, and they claimed to achieve what they call quantum supremacy, which is basically when you can do what you're supposed to do. Do a calculation using a quantum computer that would take, say, years to do on a classical computer. So they put it out, they claimed quantum supremacy. Then some physicists figured out a new algorithm that you could use on a normal computer. And they did it, first of all, on a MacBook Pro to show it could be done. And they published a paper basically showing that. And then just for fun, at a conference later that year, they presented a paper that they essentially did the same thing on a Commodore 64. Like the tiny computer from the 1980s. And they claimed they could do it faster and more efficiently than the quantum computer using their Commodore 64. They changed the name with a Q in front of Commodore, which I thought was great because like when I was at uni, and this was like, you know, in the early 90s, but still it was long after the era of the Commodore 64, there were people still using Commodore 64s to do all kinds of crazy stuff. They had like, souped it up. They had like toggle switches that didn't, who knows what. But yeah, you can do it. Commodore 64s can do a lot of things, including beat a quantum computer, so it seems.
So what does all this mean then, Chris, for the future of quantum computing? I don't understand why Microsoft would publish this paper and do this big press release if it's not clear that they've got concrete evidence to show that they've done this extremely complicated thing. Are they trying to be a part of the year of quantum, or
it's like a competition to get a quantum computer? There are a lot of people working on this. There is a lot of money being thrown at, including by the Australian government, but not astronomical amounts of money. In fact, last time I looked at this, the amount of investment was actually declining because now the game is generative AI. Mm. And, you know, there is like, you know, $1 trillion moonshot kind of projects on AI, and the money going to quantum computing seems to be going down. So there is a battle to have a proper quantum computer and prove its relevance. We talked about quantum supremacy. Quantum utility is the next buzzword to actually show that a quantum computer can be useful. But yeah, so look, it's like nuclear fusion, you know, one of these big projects that people have been working on for decades, and we all assume that it will pay off at some point, but no one really knows whether it's going to matter when it finally does, whether we'll have moved on. And same with this, I'm sure it will be useful, and maybe the AI overlords will find a use for it. But by the time there is useful quantum computers, it looks like, you know, our technological life will be quite different anyway. So it's really hard to know what the game is, really.
Well, I remember you talking about string theory and the fact that people had hyped it up, and then it was kind of like, oh, okay, that fizzled out now.
Yeah, well, it could be the same thing. I mean, the theory, at least, is solid behind quantum computers. Mm-hmm. But yeah, whether they will actually do anything useful is yet to be seen. And like I said, it seems to be mostly hype at the moment. I don't want to like bring down anyone who's working on this stuff, because people are doing good work. Mm. Absolutely. But yeah, in terms of changing our lives, that's probably still a long way off.
I think we're lost.
We're not lost.
Not even any short-range radio signals yet?
Except for a single, very powerful radio emission.
Of course, a transmitter of that sort isn't exactly standard equipment.
Science and technology must be absolutely mind-boggling.
Of course, that's mostly on the theoretical side.
What so far?
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
Welcome back. You are listening to Lost in Science, half an hour of science over your airwaves. And we are really lucky today to be joined by Saini Samim. Welcome, Saini. It's lovely to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me here, Lyndon. I'm so excited to be here.
Now, Saini, I have brought you in because you have just finished your PhD. But before we get into the nitty-gritty of what you've done, I was wondering if you could maybe define yourself for me. What do you define yourself as a researcher?
That's a great question. I think my real answer is at the moment that I'm still figuring it out. If you think about, like, for example, what I would call myself as definition term, it would be a geologist. But with specifically, I think I ended up doing research in a lot of tephra, which is defined as a tephrachronologist. So
a tephrachronologist? That's not the answer I was expecting from you. What is a tephrachronologist?
Well, it turns out that volcanic eruptions, they can be large and they're very explosive and they fly over tons of distances. And what they lay out as over time is called as tephra. So if you can time the volcanic eruptions and link them from one place to another, that is called tephrachronology. So any geologist who studies the tephra from different places and can date each of the volcanic eruptions is known as a tephrachronologist.
Wow, there you go. Is there a big community of tephrachronologists in Australia?
I guess not. I feel like in terms of tephrachronologists, since we don't have too many volcanoes here in Australia, maybe not as much, but probably a huger community or a larger community in New Zealand where there's tons of volcanoes. And I see a ton of paper coming from like Italy and Indonesia. In Antarctica, there's some scientists, and definitely towards Greenland, where they're looking at ice cores. So, yeah, quite a few community up in Europe, but much more larger community in New Zealand, for example.
Ah, yeah. There you go. So your research project that you've just finished, I understand that wasn't based in New Zealand, though.
No.
That was based in Africa, in Kenya, is that right? Are you able to tell us a little bit about what you were looking at over there?
Of course. There are tons of volcanoes in the Great Rift Valley in Africa, where the continent of Africa is slowly splitting apart into two over millions of years, of course. But there are so many volcanoes that have been erupting for the last 4 million years and even going back in time up to like 10, 12 million years that I have been studying some of the volcanic eruptions from like present day until like the 4 million years ago, which are associated with early human fossils. So Africa, aside from the Great Rift Valley, is also known like as the birthplace of humankind. So tons of places in Africa have been known to yield so many fossils that were crucial to understand our past, like our human past. And so scientists have been looking in multiple places around the area to not only to study the fossils of how humankind came to be. So in order to know, for example, what was the timeline when we started evolving, like when did we start like walking upright, or when did we start like talking, or when did we start like moving from one place to another, it's very important to get a hold of what, when and it happened and what kind of conditions it happened in. So all these volcanoes, because they have been erupting, they give us like good markers for timeline of all of these different fossils that we can find alongside the volcanic ash layers. So I have been looking at the ash layers that are associated with the fossils to understand the time lapse of when the fossils used to exist.
Wow, that is so fascinating. Working with volcanoes and fossils, that seems like a super combination from a geological point of view.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by how you go about dating these ash layers. It's ash, right, that you're finding in the rocks? Is it sort of ash in texture? Is it soft like that? Or is it harder because it's so much older and it's been compressed?
Some of them are like very, very soft and you can just like hold them in your hand. It will just fly away because it's just like ash. Whereas some of them can be a little bit harder because they have consolidated over time. But not as much as you would expect it to be. That area itself has not been huge amount of mountain building processes as of yet. So most of the ash layers, even though they're like a million years old or 2 million years old, they're pretty friable. So like it's like regular beach sand, yes.
Okay. So then you've been out to Kenya, yeah. You've been out to the Rift Valley and you've collected some samples, yeah. Is that right? Is the sample collecting process a really crucial part of understanding the timing in terms of seeing where these ash layers exist in the landscape? Is that really useful to you, like going there physically? Or if somebody brought you some rocks, would that be enough for you to do the work that you need to do?
We were very lucky in terms of sample collection because so many people have been working in there. I think like research started in this area in the like early 1910s, 20s. So they have done a lot of research already in that area. So we inherited a few of the samples. Since I started my project during COVID, I got to work on the samples first that were inherited until we could make the trip back to Kenya, or for the first time for me to Kenya. But what I found really cool was that there were some samples that I could look at and analyze in the laboratory and make some preliminary assumptions like, oh, maybe this is what is happening geologically at the time. And being able to go there, like afterwards, going to the field and like going to the site, it's the same site that they collected the rocks from that I was already analyzing, but seeing it actually happen with physical evidence was awesome. So like, I think it's a two-way process. So being out in the field, sometimes it can make some preliminary assumptions and then you collect the rocks, so you already have a good idea. But for me, doing that backwards, like having the samples firsthand and then going into the field was not a bad, you know, experience altogether.
Tell us then about the dating process. Yeah. You collect the rocks or you have the samples that exist already. Mm. How do you go about determining the age of these ash layers?
Great. Question.
The question, right?
Yeah. Well, to simplify it, like in a few sentences, would be that ash layers, like any volcanic eruptions, what happens with a volcano is like as a magma or a lava that cools down after it has erupted, it can contain crystals within them. So these crystals are what is very crucial to us and it can help us tell time. So crystals, for example, potassium-rich feldspars, which are the ones that we try to date. Potassium is slightly radioactive, but if present in huge amounts, can help us tell time backwards. So how radioactivity works is that you get one particular element that decays into another element over a set period of time. So because you can't know exactly what was there initially, if you just measure how much quantity of a particular element that you get now, because it's a fixed period of time it took to decay to that element, you can then back calculate how much of potassium was there in the past. So what we do is like we get the samples in, we get the crystals in, we measure how much of in potassium system, it's like potassium decays into argon. So what we do is like measure how much argon we have in the crystals, and that tells us how much potassium used to be with the help of an equation that we did not develop, but other smart people did. So by using that equation, we can then decide, okay, it took that amount of time to have that much of potassium in the past. So that's how you go about with radiometric dating. But yes, if the crystals are not there, it's quite hard to then determine when the ash layer erupted or when the particular eruption happened. So these crystals are quite precious to us. So what we do in the field is definitely look for rocks that might contain the crystal so that we can extract it and then we can measure some elements out of the crystal.
And can you tell that you've found one of those particular rocks in the field, or do you really need to look at it at the microscopic level before you can say, hurrah, we found the special crystal?
Another great question. Of course, it's very hard to know. Sometimes they're very large. Like when we say large, it's like 2 millimeters, so we can see it through naked eyes. But like sometimes they are quite tiny. I guess the ideal size that we try to target would be like 0.5 to 1 millimeter. And that's hard to know unless you open it up. So I guess in our field days when we went in Kenya, we would spend like a long day. So, but it's very hot out there. So what we would do is like we would go out early in the morning, like 7:30 to 11 o'clock before the sun is at its peak. And then we would go out for a collection of the rocks. And once we come back and have a little bit of a rest in the afternoon time, what we'd start doing is like little crushing. They're so soft rocks that we had that we can easily use just a little mullet sometimes to like bash it up a little bit, and it was easy enough to like sieve through. So it was a lot of sieving and just like crushing with the mullet and looking for some tiny crystals under a microscope. And if it's there, I think this is the happiest for us. And like, if it's not there, then well, we try to do the best we can at the time. So yeah,
you try again tomorrow to find more rocks, I guess. Yeah, always hunting. Now, this approach, this potassium argon dating, where you're looking at the half life, I guess, or the conversion of the one element to another. How accurate is that? Because I understand one aspect of your PhD was to really improve our accuracy of knowing when these different volcanic eruptions occurred.
Actually, do not do potassium argon dating. To be honest, we do argon argon dating, which is already an improved version of potassium argon. So potassium argon was the initial approach that people applied when the system was initially analyzed. And argon argon is a much more improved, accurate version than potassium argon, because you can, rather than measuring potassium and argon at the same time, you're measuring argon argon in the same instrument without utilizing different methods. So that kind of gives you more certainty of the fact that if you're analyzing argon and argon, two different isotopes of argon in the same instrument, you can be sure of how the instrument is behaving. Whereas if you're doing potassium and argon at the same time, it would be a different instrument analyzing potassium and a different instrument analyzing argon. So there's lots of uncertainties between methods. So argon-argon already is a very improved approach over potassium argon. But then what we did in our research group at the Noble Research Group in the University of Melbourne was we have a newer generation of mass spectrometers which have got very increased capability of precision. And so let's suppose if people used to get plus or minus 20,000 years error or uncertainty associated with a volcanic eruption date, we can decrease it now down to like at least 1,000 years or lower. So that way, if eruptions were happening at least 3 or 4 times within a 10,000 year interval, we can see each of the eruptions, for example, and that gives us a much more better control in terms of understanding the fossils age or understanding how, for example, so many eruptions were impacting these environments where the human beings used to live in. So that did become a big part of my project. So to improve the precision and also getting good at age control on the volcanic eruption itself, and also getting a good control on the chemistry of the volcanic ashes as well.
I want to know what you found with this increased uncertainty. Can you now tell us the sort of environment that these early hominids were living in? Was it volcano, volcano, volcano? What did you find? What was the conclusion?
I guess it's a bit hard to tell by myself, honestly. It's a very big group effort. So so many people are working in this. So my finding would be just like adding a very, very small piece to the big jigsaw puzzle of which is understanding humankind in general. But what I thought was very interesting was this particular fossil called the Neuroeconomy Boy, which is the most complete skeleton of human Homo erectus ever found, which is our direct ancestor. And so this fossil, like, had a large uncertainty, and people didn't know, like, what kind of time period or what kind of environment period they used to live in. But by reducing down the uncertainties on the volcanic ash eruptions, I could see that it was living in a time where there was lots of volcanic eruption within the Turkana Basin. So what's cool about it is that I think at the time the environment was good enough for it to live in as well. So it was far away from the volcanoes for sure, but there was lots of precipitation around, so lots of rainfall at the same time. Lots of fauna was actually like surviving and thriving throughout. So irregardless of so many explosions happening, they were actually living in a good time period. So
that's fascinating. So thank you for sharing that, Sani. It's amazing to think about the landscapes that these fossils that we see in museums around the world were living in. And your research, I know you say you're just a small part, but it's still an important part. Little brick by little brick is how we build our knowledge. Thanks so much for joining us here in Lost in Science.
Thank you so much, Lindsay. I had a great time.
And that's it for another episode of Lost in Science. Lost in Science is recorded for 3CR in Melbourne on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. And it airs across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We would love you to get in touch with us. You can email us at lostinsci@gmail.com, or you can find us on Facebook, we're Lost in Science on 3CR, or on Twitter, where we're at lostinscience1. You can find us on your favourite podcast app, where if you get the chance, please give us a good rating and review, as that will raise us up in the search rankings so other people can find the science. Or you can listen to us however you listen to us now, where the same time every week, Claire, Stu and Chris get
Lost in Science.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.